$100, and when they died, they sent me $100.
Now, is that how you became involved in the Mooney Billings case?
Well, as I say, I had already soapboxed for Mooney Billings up in Spokane, but I had never saw either of them until then, and naturally, not being in San Francisco, I wasn't covering any hearings, but from that time on, from 1921 on, I covered them all as long as either of them was in prison. And got to be very closely connected, though I never was on the committee or in the official, but I knew everybody concerned.
Now, you were a friend of Mary Gallagher's, weren't you?
I was what?
You were a friend of Mary Gallagher's, weren't you?
Oh, yes, great friend of Mary Gallagher's. Actually, I knew Mary better after that period. I didn't know her awfully well until she, I don't suppose she'd moved down. Did you know her?
No, she...
Because I was wondering if you knew her daughter, Jean Robeson.
Oh, yeah?
She was married to Stuart Robeson, the old actor, and Jean is their daughter, and Jean has one or some multiple sclerosis or something like that, one of those horrible... Mm-hmm. Or Parkinson's disease, something, and now Mary's dead. I heard from Jean once or twice, but what's the cover? I imagine she's in something like a poorhouse now. There's nothing else she could do. She couldn't work.
Now, what was the politics of the paper?
It had none. We were always accused, of course, of being a communist outfit, and that there were quite a number of communists connected with it, but there were also quite a number of non-communists. But what it was pro-labor. And at one time, we even had ordinary newspapers in our... And we had the New York Herald, I remember, at one time. And at the peak of our... prosperity, I think we had something like 300 papers all over the country. And of course, my stuff went in all of them. Mm-hmm. So if I'm known at all in those circles, it's from that. And I still hear occasionally from people who read my things in the old days. And then, of course, through that, through covering all these things, I got material that I began writing articles about criminals and cases and things like that for both the Nation and New Republic. I wrote for them frequently for a long time.
So you became more involved in political essays at that time?
Well, I don't really call it political. Of course, when I came to California, women didn't have a suffrage all over the country. But as I told you, I voted first in 1916 in San Diego, or Los Angeles. But... until, for many years, I always registered to climb the state, and we voted for, always voted the socialist ticket that was won. In fact, I think one year, the year that we both left the Socialist Party, we were so angry at their right-wing predominance that we voted for Foster and whatever the other person was on the communist ticket. We're the only people in Sausalito who did that, registered one vote for each.
Was Sausalito, what kind of community at that time?
See, we lived in Sausalito for 14 years.
What sort of community was it at that time? What? There weren't very many radicals in Sausalito.
Of course not. Sausalito was a funny kind of place. It's always been a hangout for criminals, you know. That's where Babyface Nelson hung, hid out. I accidentally bought his Tommy gun case when I was buying things to move my things over. Anyway, it was part fishing village, part artists and writers' suburban home, and part a pretty tough gambling and criminal joint. And it was always for instance, we always said that the 18th Amendment wasn't passed in Northern County. Nobody paid attention to it.
How did you happen to move there instead of living in San Francisco or Oakland?
Well... we lived in Mill Valley for 2 years, and then a woman from whom we rented the house wanted to sell it, so we moved back to the city for a year and got burglarized and decided we were better off in a suburb. And by that time, we had a very close friend who lived in Sausalito. And at first, we just had to rent a flat in Sausalito, almost on the waterfront, until we found the house that we lived in for about 13 years.
Now, what kind of work did you do to supplement your income from the Federal Express after you left?
Well, I was, as I said, until 1923, I was with the Maryland. Then I was out of a job for a while, and I spent one summer, two summers, in fact, as substitute while the office manager at the Drew Cramming School out on California Street was on vacation, and I handled it, ran the office there. And then for a while I was secretary to the president of a big piano company, not Sherman Clay, Kohler and Company or something like that. I know one day in the files I found their correspondence on the subject of Sherman Clay, whom they hated. All kinds of scandalous and scurrilous things about both Sherman and Clay. But I think I lasted in that place about 3 months, because for one thing, I'd been doing the dictating for 5 years, and I wasn't used to being dictated to. And for another thing, it was most uncomfortable physically. It was in an old building down there on Farrell Street, and everybody had cold all the time. It was always chilly and windy. So I got out of that. And don't ask me what I did. By that time, I was selling quite a lot of stuff for magazines, but I can't remember. I've had so many jobs.
You had to keep working still. You weren't making enough at your writing yet.
Well, I wasn't able to live purely by writing until about, most 30 years ago. I could have managed by the time of World War II, but I actually spent 2 years in public relations for working with the public relations and unknown newspaper guild.
Now, how much time were you devoting to the labor causes then during this period?
How do you mean?
Well, it sounds like you had various jobs, and you were also a reporter, and you were also doing your own writing.
Well, there's 24 hours in every day. And besides, there were long periods when I was out of a job. Unfortunately, I wrote quite a number of things for the Old Spinners magazine and the Sterling Harpers. And in other words, I was getting up in the world. And as I say, we always combined our money. Man, we had, was the editor of the paper and had other, and then of course when we started the Science League, he got a salary as president and founder.
Now he must have been making some income from his books too, wasn't he? Or did they come later?
You mean from his history?
From his science books.
Well, I think that was when we discovered Holden and Julius, the little blue books in Girard, Kansas. And for about 5 years, we both wrote prolifically for him. You got $50 cash for 15,000 words. Maynard wrote something like 35 little blue books for him, mostly science. And I wrote at least 15 translations, biographies and translations from Roman, from Latin authors, Latin being my special field. And also, I wrote a number, I wrote one for him on Mussolini and the fascist movement in Italy and all kinds of things. I just made wrote one on how to teach yourself to play the piano. I wrote one on how to teach yourself to type, such typing. And in other words, the $50 came in regularly. And when Maynard wrote his massive double, four-volume Key to Evolution, Holden and Julius actually doubled his pay and paid him $100 for 15,000 words.
Now,
that was our main source of income at that time. And, of course, anything you sell otherwise, fine.
Mm-hmm. Now, was your involvement with labor primarily as a reporter, or did you ever become more actively involved in some strikes and things?
I was purely a reporter. I had to be. I mean, I was covering everything, every phase and gamut of the labor movement. I certainly couldn't be affiliated with any of it. And I was, actually. In 1919, stopped editing the World in Oakland for the second time. He'd read it before from 1913. He moved out of Oakland altogether, and then we decided we ought to join. That was the year we lived in San Francisco, and we decided we ought to join local San Francisco. So we did go to all the meetings, and he was always a well-known organizer and speaker, and he lectured all the time, of course. And that was where most of his income came from his lectures. He had a long series of letters in various places. And we belonged to local San Francisco until we both left the party in 1922.
I see.
After that, that's the only act, and I can't say we had active. We went to meetings, and when things were discussed, I was always on my hind feet talking about them, but I never did anything else.
Now, what were your relationships? When did you join the Socialist Party?
Well, by that time, I had softened some of my anti-political views. In other words, made it persuasive. It was the only thing that we ever disagreed on. Once he got so angry that he went over and stayed in Oakland for 2 days, I had to go over and get him back. So, gradually, I softened my views, and since actually the local here was pretty left wing, but then of course by the end of 1919 the communists had started, and they raided the place and invaded it and made things generally actually not even safe to go to a meeting. You never knew when they were going to bust the door open and begin throwing things around. I associate one of that group of young flaming communists who is now very aged with gray hair and missing teeth, and I see him over in Oakland at the humanist house there. He even came to see me once, but we don't refer to those days. He's forgotten them.
What was your attitude towards the Russian Revolution?
Well, that's a large question that can't be answered simply. I suppose I've always been for complete, not for reform, but for revolution, but I'd have to write a thesis on it to answer your question sensibly.
Were you initially very favorably impressed, and then changed in 1924 or so, or from the very beginning did you have reservations?
You mean, naturally everything that, those were very disturbed times, and not only here, but also everywhere. Well, I'll never forget the day that they murdered Karl Liebknecht and Rosa Luxemburg. And I remember coming home to Mill Valley that night, and the minute he opened the door, he said, "What's the matter? You can see from my face." And I remember saying, they'd killed Rosa Luxemburg and Karl Liebknecht, and threw their bodies in the river. And that night, our friend that we'd made from Sausalito came up to Mill Valley, and we all sat and spent the whole evening mourning over this. But we were all terribly involved in everything that was happening. And I suppose we said that neither of us ever was communist, and was not entirely in sympathy with after the promising early days. But we were certainly not liberals or reformers. I suppose we would say we were good Marxists. Actually, we probably were among the very few socialists who ever read more than the first volume of Das Kapital.
Now, what made you finally decide to leave the Socialist Party then? Why did you join me? Primarily because of Maynard then?
Well, no, by that time I was willing to join him. I mean, I suppose he was probably, his arguments had finally won me over. But he never said come and join or anything like that. It was up to me if I wanted to join, okay, I did. But I thought as long as we're right here in the city, we ought to do something active and not just, well, especially as Maynard had been for so many years one of their prominent people and organized all over the country and all that. Their papers in three different places.
The relationship then between the socialists and the communists was rather stormy during this period.
At that time it was, yes. Well, as I said, they even stole all of the subscribers at the World, so it was impossible to know whose subscription was due or anything. And they played very rough, so that I can't say we were on amicable terms at that time. But of course, after as soon as Russia got into the war, well, then suddenly. They were very chummy with us. Then we could be some use to them. Before that, of course, they were
Now what led you to then leaving the Socialist Party?
Why did we leave? Because they'd gone too far to the right and become practically a branch of the Democratic Party. And as I said, we both registered, always declined to state until 1935, when Nixon started on Helen Hayden Douglas. I switched to Democratic to be able to vote for her. I was in Hawaii, but I voted an absentee ballot. And since then, I've just been registered Democrat because it's too much trouble. Mm-hmm. Besides, I can vote in the primaries now, and I couldn't vote before.
Now, once you left the Socialist Party, what sort of political activities in life did you have?
Well, when we first left, we had no political... You see, Maynard was very close to Gene Debs. He was our dear personal friend. And Maynard had been his campaign manager when he ran for Congress in Indiana in 1913. So we always voted the Socialist ticket, but the people who were in control and people like... Well, I was just going to ask you, when you told me your maiden name was Berger, if you're related to Victor.
Victor Berger, no.
Well, he was one of those... Right wings in Meyer London, a lot more of them, and Maynard had been fighting them from the beginning, had always been in the left wing of the Socialist Party, and now they were gaining control of the whole party. And as I say, I can't remember what I told you and what I told Mr. Rhodes, but finally, in the campaign in 1922, whatever it wasn't presidential, but the election was, they had billboards around saying socialism versus the cost of living, and that was about the last straw. I wrote a letter to what was her name, the then state secretary Isabel something, and said that to his great regret, after he joined in 1906 and had been one of their standbys for all those years, and he said to his great regret that his party had now gotten to the point where he couldn't conscientiously be affiliated with it, so we both resigned. Neither of us ever belonged to anything permanent in any real sense at all, never formally.
So you became sort of freelance politically then? You had no real ties to any of
no.
the other radical groups?
No, except that, as I say, until 1935, I was steeped in the And the 1934 strike, of course, I covered every day. The day Maynard died, I sent him my story as usual.
Now, he died in 34?
He died in June 1934, right in the middle of the strike.
In the middle of the strike?
Just before the general strike.
Now, were you involved in the strike, or again, just as a reporter?
Well, I was involved only to the extent of being anywhere that I could get in. I was standing on, at that time, there was a kind of bridge over the Embarcadero to the ferry building, which was then, of course, in use because of the ferries. And that was a block from where, from Bloody, where they had Bloody Thursday, wasn't it, where they shot as people went, and the police used tear gas, and I know some of it came up. I remember getting some of it. I was standing as near as I'd let any civilian stand, so to be able to report just what happened. And the police shot these two men down, killed them both.
Now, by that time, did you still keep other jobs, or were you primarily working for the press and maybe trying to make a living from your writing?
I can't remember. This is so far back, I can't remember dates or anything like that, except by things like the 1934 strike. But I don't think until I did this public relations work for the city itself in 19, during World War II, I don't think that I had any regular job after my piano company. We got along, and, well, as I say, that's when we started working with Haldeman Julius, and I had to type all Maynard's. He didn't type. I not only had to write my own books, I had to type his, and they were 15,000 words apiece, so it kept me quite busy, thank you. And then, of course, in the beginning of 1934, Maynard had a stroke, and from that time on, he was completely paralyzed and couldn't talk.
Now, how old was he then?
He was only 61.
Now, backtracking a little bit, during the following the Mooney Billings trial and when they were in prison, did you continue to be in contact with them while they were in prison then?
Well,
as for the paper?
Well, after the Federated Press died, I worked for 2 years for the only Labor Daily in the United States. It was called Labor's Daily. It was published in Davenport, Iowa. And I was their correspondent, their reporter here. And then they died. And then I worked, then we had that long newspaper strike. I see, I joined the Newspaper Guild in 1936. I had my 25-year pin. I didn't take my honorable withdrawal card until 2 or 3 years after that. So during the San Jose strike, they got out, the strikers got out of the paper of their own. And I did a column daily for there was no paper being published in San Jose, and this was general news. In other words, it was swiped from mostly the New York Times and the Wall Street Journal at their recommendation. But I made a column out of it every day. But that was the last newspaper job I had, because there aren't any more labor papers.
Now, when was that?
That was 1957 or 1958, and about 1959, something like that.
But your commitment was to labor paper. You weren't interested in becoming a reporter in general. It was really just for labor.
Yes, of course. I was a sympathetic and prejudiced reporter. Naturally, I was all the our people were always innocent, for instance. The strikers were always right. The police were always wrong.
Now, how did you become involved with the Mooney case?
With what?
With the Mooney case.
Well, you couldn't very well be working for the Labor Wire Service and not be involved with the Mooney case. It was the biggest case we had in this whole country. It was like saying that you lived in Boston, how'd you get involved in the Psycho Vanzetti case? If you were anybody who can in any way connected, why naturally? Then what happened was that this was long after it was I can't remember the year. It was about 1935, yes. It was after Maynard's death. Mooney heard that, he was still in San Quentin, of course, and he heard the communists were going to get out a book about the case. And by that time, sometimes he was chummy with them and sometimes he wasn't. At that time, he wasn't. So he was very much afraid they'd get it out, and he wanted one. He wanted a biography from going back to the Hibernian ancestors. So he sent word through the committee to me to ask me if I would write it. And it meant that I had to get special permission. For several months, I went up to San Quentin every week and had a half an hour. And Mooney told me what he wanted said. And I had my questions prepared, you know, and all that kind of thing. But I wasn't allowed to take notes, so as soon as they took him away, I'd go to the ladies' room and write down everything I could remember. Well, I got the book done. It was a complete history of Thomas Mooney from birth to 1935. And then the communists didn't have money enough, and they didn't bring the book out. So the Mooney committee didn't have money enough. And what Tom did do, he had about 100 copies made of the book and sent it around all over the country. I know I was visiting friends in Connecticut that year when I went east for a year, and while I was there, a copy appeared for sent on to San Francisco for their judgment, because they'd written a book on this one called, I don't know whether you ever saw this book, it's really rather nice.
Were you the author on the Mooney book, or were you just ghostwriting it for him?
You mean after...
On the book that he never did, that was just...
Well, I couldn't do anything more with the book. It was Mooney's property. He paid me $25 a week, or the committee did, to go up to San Quentin.
I see.
It was a committee if it belonged to anybody. Now, it never was published.
How did you get permission to go into San Quentin? Because
well, I don't know. I knew... I had begun by that time to write a little on criminology, too, and I knew Warden Duffy. And I also, his sister, who was Ethel Duffy Turner, was then a well-known novelist, and I knew her very well, and we were in the Authors Guild together. So somehow I got permission to... I mean, I could have made the regular visitors, I probably could have got on his visitors list, but he wasn't supposed to see reporters. And and nobody was supposed to come once a week. But I didn't get, I don't remember how many months I went up every week.
Now, most people I've talked to who were in any way involved in the case didn't like Mooney very much personally.
No, I hated Mooney.
Oh, you did?
Everybody did that knew him. You know, Frank Walsh, who was a distinguished New York attorney who came out here free of charge to help defend Mooney. I got to know Frank very well, and he always said he had two ambitions. One was to get Mooney free, because he was obviously framed, and the second was to push the son of a bitch in the bay. And that was about the way we all felt. Of course, there were people like poor Rena and his sister Anna, who got to be quite a good friend of mine, and his old mother used to breathe down my neck and say, "Oh God, it's awful! Oh God, it's awful!" And I knew the whole family and everybody connected with it. Before I got through, I was you got to know people. You know, you go to going to the committee meetings all the time and all that.
So you were really you're. A lot of energy was involved in that whole case.
But of course, I also was covering every kind of labor convention. I covered the convention at which the CIO was formed. I covered the convention, and by that time I was a member of the Newspaper Guild when we joined the CIO. And I can't remember any kind of, every strike of any kind I covered, and any labor cases of any sort that involved arrests or imprisonment I covered.
Now, what was the triggering of the San Francisco General Strike in 1934?
What was
what actually triggered the general strike in 1934?
Well, it started as the longshoremen strike. The general strike was pretty feeble and lasted only a few days. But it did close everything down. But it was primarily because of what they called a shape-up. Every morning early, about 5 o'clock, all the people who wanted work as longshoremen had to gather on the docks, and then the straw bosses would pick out the ones they wanted, who were usually the ones who had paid them. The whole thing was very corrupt. It was the old ILA, which is still corrupt. And the rest could go home without any money and another day unemployed. And I should say what triggered it was Harry Bridges. There's a biography of him just out. And I've known Harry for years, of course. That was another thing. My CIO headquarters was right around the corner here, and I was there every day getting all kinds of material. And I knew Morris Lutzen very well. He died a few months ago. He was the editor of the Dispatcher. I got to know Harry very well, and a lot of the others, Schmidt and Stivelar, and all of the people connected with. I knew everybody at the ILWU there. But I should say that what triggered the strike was what triggers every strike: bad working conditions.
Well, how difficult was it to organize that kind of wide support, though, for the ILWU strike? For the rest of labor to support, to show that sort of support?
Well, when you say wartime, you mean World War II, I suppose.
No, how difficult was it for the rest of labor to mobilize in support of the ILWU strike in 1934?
You mean what? The rest of the labor, what their attitude was. The ILWU was actually, it had all been part of the ILA. Harry Bridges actually drew it, took it out, and made it into a new union. It was before he was a CIO. And they belonged to it and then left it, like a great many other unions. But the ILA belonged to the Labor Council. But the Labor Council was made up, of course, of the old diehards who were just feathering their own nests, what many used to call the Dukes of Labor, Picard artists and pork choppers.
Now, but you were able to, the paper would cover both the right
paper,
and left of labor,
yes.
Actually.
Most of my stuff I sent by telegram. It was things that weren't timely. I mailed, but most of my work was wire service. But what do you mean? What was the attitude
of labor generally in the city? Seemed to have mobilized.
As I said, the old boys in the Labor Council and especially in the Building Trades Council and in the old line unions, you had to pull teeth to get any news out of them because they took it for granted that we were a communist outfit. But all the new, young, aggressive unions, and especially all the industrial unions, were cooperated very well. They were delighted to get the publicity. The regular papers, of course, didn't publish anything except a few dodgy remarks about the Orthodox leaders. Those were the days of Sammy Gompers. Oh, yes, I think one thing that I'd forgotten, one reason I think that made it easy for them to get rid of me at the Maryland was I had a friend, a newspaper woman who married a member of the IWW, Ed Archibald. We called him Archie. And Archie worked as what we call a hard hat now, in building construction. And unfortunately, he was working on a building that somehow he fell down the unfinished elevator staff 7 floors, hit his head on some iron pipes, and wasn't expected to live, and was very badly injured, unconscious for a long time. And we insured the company that he was working for. So I got the claim from them, and I had the pleasant job of calling Kate up and telling her. She just got back from the hospital with their baby. And I can remember saying, is Archie working? Yes, he's working for Russo and Russo. And then I said, Kate, are you alone? No, she had somebody there. And I said, well, I'm sorry, I have to tell you. And I told her about it. And all she said was, is he dead? And I said, no, but he's unconscious, and he's at the central emergency hospital, and you can't see him yet. Well, actually, he did finally recover, but for a long time he was partly paralyzed. He couldn't close one eye, and he couldn't close the side of his mouth and all that. And I did my very best to do things for him. But while he was unconscious, he was weeks in the Franklin Hospital, which we used then, and he was delirious. And he was a big fellow with a loud voice, and you'd hear ringing down the halls that he and I were going to Washington to convert Sammy Gompers to the IWW. That was reported back, but also it was no help whatever to me. And then the funny thing was I broke my neck trying to do things for Archie, and he decided he wanted to go up back where he came from, Washington. Cape was willing to go up there. She could always get a newspaper job. He wanted to start a little chicken farm. His sister had one or something. I managed to get him a lump sum instead of this weekly name, enough so that he could really start the thing. Well, that was just the time that Maynard had his first heart attack. It was in 1922. And so any time that I wasn't at work, I simply couldn't do the things that, you know, going to see Archie and all that kind of thing. I couldn't do anything except take care of Maynard and do my go to work. And Archie got very much offended. I don't know how he persuaded Kate also to be my friend before she ever saw Archie, but they both became they just dropped me. They had nothing more to do with me, and I understand that they did go up, and Archie finally recovered and even worked as a truck driver. But I never heard from either of them again, and I presume they're both dead. A few weeks ago, somebody sent me a copy of an old book in San Francisco that Kate had written under her pseudonym of Elmira Bailey. I have it here, vignettes of San Francisco, very nice thing. And they were it was an old paper then, a daily called The Journal that she was on. These were columns she had in a new book. But I haven't heard from them for years.
Now, after Maynard's death, then, is when you moved in here? After his death is when you then moved in here?
You mean after Maynard died? I was in Honolulu for a long time with one of my very close friends, who's also now dead. And then I was east. Last time I went back home, Philadelphia. I went for my mother's 80th birthday. And I promised to come back for their golden wedding the next year, but she was dead before then. And I was east for about a year then. And then when I came back, I came to San Francisco. And I was one of the few non-relief workers on the Writers' Project at WPA from 1936 to 1939. And also that's how I was on the editorial board of the California Guide, and I wrote up all the big cities in California. Excuse me. You can erase that from the tape. Wait till I consult my senile memory. I started to tell you about something else. Oh, yes. In 1939, they were holding the deportation hearings on bridges over in Angel Island in the Bay. And the only way the press could cover it was a little launch went off in the morning and then brought you back in the afternoon. Well, I had already had an arrangement that I could, at that time the guide was out, and I didn't do very much on the San Francisco guide, but my book, They Were San Franciscans, was originally a WPA project, and then after the Wright project died, I got possession of it myself and had it published regularly. But so because I was working on that, the understanding was, well, it's about time if I offered you some. Oh, you don't smoke. You don't.
No,
I Federated Press Guards found I had to cover that hearing. So that meant I had to go in the launch there and back. I couldn't swim. And that was the time when they were trying to weed the communists out of the WPA. If you read Jerry Mangione's book that just came out, The Dream and the Deal, you'll get some really good stuff on the WPA and on the arts projects. So, in particular, the writers. So there was more or less of a battle on, especially as a good many of the old line communists were perfectly willing to purge themselves and said they never had been members of the party. So there was pretty ill feeling among those who were and those who weren't. And somebody, I never found out who, but I did find out it was one of these crypto-communists reported me to the then manager, direct supervisor, that I was spending all day at the... Well, we had to sign up in the morning when we came in. The understanding was that I signed up every morning. In the old Veterans Building, there's a day's paper I see they're going to tear down. That was at then our office and our headquarters. And then I was supposed to work at home. Well, I worked 8 hours a day, but I didn't work from 9 to 5, or 9 to 4, I think it was. And so the, what was his name, Paul Johnson, who was the last supervisor before the thing died, called me into his office, and he was a very straight-laced, arbitrary kind of man. And he informed me that I'd committed a felony and I could be sent to the penitentiary and a few things like that. And so I told him, well, I suppose that if that was the way he thought, I didn't belong in the project. And it was, we used to say, you were separated. You weren't fired, you were separated. So I separated myself. So that was the last job I, or the steady job I had until I, except during the war.
Did you start getting into the criminology and things as a way to be more lucrative as a writer?
You mean, how did I...
How did you get into these other fields
well,
in your writing?
Well, I got in actually by writing detective stories. I got in through fiction, and then I got more and more interested in knowing Mooney and knowing all these labor prisoners, so many of them that I knew, and... people like and the anti-war prisoners who were in Alcatraz during World War I, and all sorts of people that we met, and so I got more and more interested in the history of in criminology and the history of prisons and that sort of thing, and I began, and I'd written so many articles for Nation and New Republic on various labor prison victims and that sort of thing. It was, and then besides our bookstore, Alderman Julius, he had at one time half a dozen different kinds of magazines, monthlies and weeklies and gunners, well, all, for all of which we wrote. And I remember once in one of his magazines, I think it was Alderman Julius Monthly, I had an article called What the Detectives Detect, making fun of some of the stupid things they do. So I got a letter from a convict in San Quentin who wrote me that he just read the article and he was heartily in favor of it, and he told me that one time when he was on the lam and his picture was in every post office, he had attended a detectives convention in New Jersey and drunk in the bars with them all, and nobody ever paid any attention to her. Well, I got to know him very well indeed, and that was one of Macon's discoveries, Ernest Booth. And when Macon and Nathan edited the Smart Set, he found a perfect hive of auctorial energy in San Quentin. And not only Booth, but Robert Joyce Tasker and Joe Mackey, who was an ex-jockey, and a whole half a dozen of them were writing books. And Knopf published, I have both the Ernest Sealing Through Life and Tasker's Grimhaven, which was about San Quentin. And then when Ernest got out, first he sent his wife to see us, and she became one of our very best friends, and she still is mine. No, she lives in Tucson now.